Hi, welcome. It's a special edition of that Millwall podcast. Today I'm joined with two different faces, one we've had on before and one we haven't. I'm joined today by the one and only Kieran from the Price of Football. How you doing, Kieran? You all right?
Yeah, sound all all good, Mickey. Yeah, I would have my mucker from the Price of Football on, but he's a Palace fan, and I think you and Palace have got a meeting coming up in a few weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we might have to do it. I think we might have to try and get Kevin on before the week before when we do a show reviewing that game, just to get him on so we can abuse him, or he can abuse us, maybe one of the way. But yeah, it'd be a good crack to have him on. I'll probably be outdone by his comedy wit, to be fair. But yeah, and we've got someone who is very vocal across the forums and across Twitter. You've probably seen him quite a few times. We've got Phil Clark. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hi, Mickey. Nice to see you again. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Phil.
Right, what we're going to do today is obviously the Millwall figures have come out. It's that time of the year where Millwall's accounts are released. There's no point me going through the accounts, or me and Omar going through the accounts, because we're pretty much don't know the ins and outs. So we thought we'd just get an expert, which is obviously Kieran. That's his job. That's what he does for a living, and teaches and everything else around those stuff. And we've got Phil on as well, who's been quite active over social media the last few days, talking about the figures. And also he should be able to bring some good questions towards Kieran. So without further ado, then we will crack on. So the figures were released for the last 12 months, Kieran. Let's start at the top of it and we'll work through. So your views on them coming out, I mean, your overview, and then we'll look into it a bit more deeply.
I think they're as good as can be expected. And when we then say, well, hold on, you know, the club lost best part of £14 million in a year, and I'm saying that's good, people might think I've gone crazy. But we are living in it was a COVID season. The club still committed itself to, I think, players with new contracts. It was still active in the transfer market. I think the club is good to have a benefactor in John Berylson, who's prepared to stick his hand in his pocket every year and help to cover those losses. And those losses have been, they've been round about sort of £6 or £7 million a year for quite a few, went up in 2020. It's gone up again in 2021, should come down this season, because we're all keeping our fingers crossed that we will still be able to go to matches for the rest of the season. The club is in a solid position. Wages have doubled in 5 years, so you know the club is investing. So yeah, I would say that they're pretty solid numbers.
I mean, Millwall always seems to release their figures at the same time every year. They don't seem to defer for a year like some other clubs. And I mean, how are we compared to some of the others what have released their figures, or is there not many out there what have released yet?
Well, Millwall tend to be one of the first out of the blocks, because they're a PLC, and therefore legally they've got to publish their accounts within 6 months of the year end, whereas other clubs have got 9 months. Rishi Sunak extended that to 12 for private companies. So it's been a tough year. So we've only seen Hull produce their accounts this year. They're broadly similar. They're a club that's got an owner who has been backing them. I would say that they're decent. Norwich have put theirs out. They were promoted last season. They had the benefit of parachute payments. All clubs are suffering from the loss of matchday income, because it doesn't matter which club you are and which division, you've got TV money, you've got commercial money, you've got ticket sales. The TV money is broadly the same each year. Everybody's suffered as a result of lack of match day, although it looks as if, I mean, Millwall got £1.4 million of match day, and you might be thinking to yourself, well, what's that? That's either fans sort of foregoing their season tickets, and it's also effectively sort of transferring your season tickets into iFollow. And you've got to applaud, you know, fans who themselves are, you know, going through tough times for their commitment to the club.
No, that's it. So where should we start then, Phil? Through income, is it, or financial?
Yeah, I think just maybe picking up on some of Kieran's points there. I mean, in terms of the match day income, you know, that drop, I guess, how does that compare? What was it, 4.4 down to 1.4 million? Do you think that's what we're going to see across the rest of the league? Do you think we've managed to do quite well to keep sort of 1.5 million in there?
Yeah, because if you look at some of the clubs in the Premier League, Spurs and Manchester United have both published theirs. Manchester United, I think, at 800 grand. So,
income, right.
Because I think they'd one fixture at home, and I don't think they're even allowed to have any crowd in just for that, due to Manchester still being under lockdown. So, yeah, it's going to be effectively how much money you've earned from fans waiving their right to a refund on season tickets, and also iFollow. And we are seeing the lower you go down the leagues, the more the fans realise that they become increasingly critical to a club's financial position. If we take a look at Millwall, in a normal year, probably around about 60% of the income of the club is coming from the TV deals. And in the Premier League, it can be as high as 88, 90%. As you drop into Leagues 1 and 2, the TV incomes really falls off a cliff, and clubs are more dependent upon fans. And therefore, we're seeing a lot of the smaller clubs who have literally gone out to the fan base with a begging bowl and said, look, yeah, we cannot survive unless you're prepared to help us. And I think, you know, most fans will say, if I can, I will try to help in some way. And it's been absolutely magnificent the way that fans have come across the whole country, with the exception of the Premier League, because everybody knows that, you know, there's loads of money coming into that from TV.
Yeah, and I think with I don't know where it'll hit our accounts, whether it's these ones or probably next set of accounts, but Millwall, I don't know whether you're aware, but they very generously allowed everybody who bought a season ticket last season to roll that over, and basically gave them a free season ticket this year to offset the cost. But also last year, anyone who did buy a season ticket got a home and away iFollow voucher every week, funded by the club. So whilst traditionally they'd be selling that for £10, I guess they're buying that from the EFL at a lower rate. But nonetheless, they're funding, you know, the chairman and the board decided to offer that to the fans. So that must, in a way, that's actually cost us more money than we didn't need to spend, really.
Yeah, I think it's a vote of confidence both ways. And you've got to applaud that. You know, John Berylson, he knows where Millwall's fan base is. He knows that it's a solid working class fan base. People don't have spare cash, and anything that's been contributed by the fans is acknowledged. You know, he's in a different financial position, and he's not going to take the mickey out of fans in the way he's behaving. I think there's, looking at these numbers, there's a figure here of £2.6 million of money received in advance from season ticket sales, which is in the account. So I think that's that bit that's rolling forwards.
Rolling forward, yeah. And in terms of those losses for this year, if we were to look at all Championship clubs' accounts, say 3 years ago, pre-COVID, yeah, these losses would probably still be quite respectable, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely.
If you can call that respectable,
it's an insane division, because you've got this. It's like two oceans meeting together, where you've got clubs coming up from League One who the previous season had £1 million in TV money, and you've got clubs from relegated from the Premier League who the previous season had £100 million in TV money, and you throw them together along with what you might call the hardy perennials of the Championship, the likes of Derby and Forest and so on, who have owners who are losing money. Yeah, the average club in the Championship pre-COVID was losing £400 grand a week.
Staggering amount of money. I did a little bit of checking back in 2018, 2019. We had 366,000 fans in the ground in the year, and in the year of this account, we had 4,000.
Yeah,
when you look at it like that, you realise how massive that is for the club, because it's not just the season tickets, is it? It's the merchandise, it's the dodgy pies, it's the out-of-date beer. It's everything, isn't it? And all of that. And it just contributes. I'm joking.
I just need to say,
but it all contributes to income to the club, doesn't it?
Allegedly out-of-date beer.
it was out of date during COVID. They just didn't sell it.
Yeah, no, that's it. One ground we went to, wasn't it? I can't think what ground it was now. QPR, was it? Or Gillingham, wasn't it? Where they had a sign up saying out-of-date beer.
They were selling it cheaper. But yeah, I think that just highlights, you know, when you look at a year with 4,000 fans compared to almost 400,000, you just, you know, realise how drastic that that is for the club. Any other thoughts on the income situation at all, Kieran, for you? Is there anything that you picked
not
out
really.
That kind of looked? Central League Award in there.
Yeah, the Central League Award, which is, for people not familiar, Central League Award is that clubs in the EFL get TV money from two sources. First of all, there's the EFL's own TV deal, which is worth an estimated around about £2.5 million a year. On top of that, there's what we refer to as solidarity payments from the Premier League, which is probably around about £4.5 million. So for every £100 you're getting from the EFL, you're probably getting around about 160, 170 from the Premier League. And people say, well, does that mean the Premier League's being generous? And the answer is, well, a bit yes and a bit no, probably more no than yes, because in order to get EFL clubs to accept that money, the Premier League insisted at the time of they signed the contract that the EFL club signed up for the Elite Player Performance Plan, EPPP, which allows Premier League clubs to cherry pick the best of your talent coming through your youth system. And for a club such as Millwall, which is a London club, and as we know, there's an awful lot of young promising players in London, it's a real challenge, because you'll have some really talented kids that you'll have spotted at the age of 9, 10, 11. You then develop them for 4 or 5 years. You're also trying to give them an education and a grounding in good professional etiquette. And clubs do an awful lot of work with these kids. And then a bigger club, for want of a better phrase, will come along. And under the EPPP scheme, there's a set tariff as to what they pay you. And it is peanuts, absolute peanuts. So you get this £4.5 million a year, but you are potentially losing a lot of money as well.
You're with the finances, you're on about the compensation claim scheme, isn't it, as such for the under 23s, isn't it? So ideally what clubs need to do is that when they know that a youngster isn't necessarily going to be staying, they need to look at trying to sell them or create a bidding war for them before they reach that age, so that they don't just get the compensation claim, isn't it? Because it's arbitration and everything else, isn't it?
It is now sort of fixed fees, which is a genuine problem for kids. And remember, you're not allowed to sign a professional contract until you're 17. So what will happen is, there's scouts at every game. If they see you've got somebody really good in Millwall under 14s, 15s, even when they're 16, they sign a youth academy contract. You will get, I think it's something like £40,000 for every year they've been at the club. And you could have the next Teddy Sheringham, of course, or whatever it's going to be. So that's a real issue for me. And I think it's indicative of the way that the Premier League operates, is that it likes to make itself out to be a very generous benefactor, but they're only looking after themselves.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on that, Kieran, because you mentioned about the conditions they've put on the contract, the £4.2 million. But we've also, I noticed in the accounts, obviously taken advantage of the loan from the EFL that's, I think, funded by the Premier League, which is also conditional as well, isn't it?
Yes. So I think the loan that they've taken out is around about £7.9 million. Now, that loan...
I got about 8.3 over 3 years, I think. Not that it's probably... That's maybe with interest, I guess.
Well, it's supposed to be interest-free. I mean, if you look at the cash flow statement, it does say around about 7.8, 7.9. The Premier League has said that the EFL borrowed 117 million quid from a bank, and the Premier League said that we will pay the interest on that loan. But that loan does come with conditions. It can only be used to pay any outstanding PAYE and national insurance on the players' wages or the club's wages. It's used specifically for that purpose to stop potential winding up orders coming from HMRC. Quite a few clubs have taken advantage of the loan. I think it does have some conditions attached to it financially, which sort of tend to be linked to, the club's got to commit themselves to not spending on other areas or overspending on other areas. And this is why Derby didn't take it. And, Derby are now in administration for a variety of sins.
So in a typical year, if we borrowed whatever 7.9, 8.3 million quid, and it's got to pay off HMRC, what would a club like Millwall actually be paying HMRC? I'm guessing we're not going to use that. So that money's got to sit on our balance sheet. We can't use it other than this, but it could sit there for 3 or 4 years.
Well, it could have done, but remember, you've got to pay HMRC for your PAYE every month.
Yeah.
So I think the EFL would be pretty hacked off. And also, there are some constraints as to what you do with the money. And that loan is repayable over 3 years. So, in each
it's
this season...
It's costing us 230 grand a month or something. It's a chunk of money, isn't it?
Yeah. But it stops the threat of punishment from the tax bodies. Yeah.
And what's your view on how generous they were, bearing in mind Premier League have managed to spend, over £1 billion on transfer fees in the same time they've loaned this money to the minnows?
Well, I mean, they have given money to clubs in League One and League Two. I think they could have been more generous. I wrote an article for one of the newspapers pointing this out a year ago, and I got my wrist slapped by quite a few people for piping up about it. At the same time, clubs in the Premier League are losing a fortune. I mean, you're absolutely right. They've spent £1 billion, although the Premier League itself is very much now it's the haves and the have-nots of that £1 billion. 85-90% of that will have come from half a dozen clubs, and we know who the sneaky six are.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So then, sort of looking further into that, the revenue side of things, we took the furlough money. Have you seen much evidence from other clubs of that so far, and whether we're sort of similar numbers wise?
Yeah, practically everybody in the EFL has taken advantage of the furlough, and rightly so. The purpose of the furlough is to preserve jobs whilst the country is under lockdown. The EFL clubs don't have access to the same level of TV rights as the clubs in the Premier League. So why shouldn't they? We've still got a Millwall to support. We've still got a Gillingham to support. We've still got a Southend to support. And I think football's actually done reasonably well to come through this with relatively few casualties. Because you look at the high street, you look at pubs and clubs, they've all been absolutely hammered. So football's come out of it reasonably well.
You've also got contractual agreements, haven't you, with the big TV providers, that when there was no games, that they were threatening or they were wanting money back to say, well, look, you haven't fulfilled your side of the contract. Doesn't matter what the reason is. We've lost out on advertising and everything else. We want X amount back from every club. And whether that be, 100 grand from every club in the lower league, it's a lot of money to suddenly, in the current situation, to suddenly go knock on the door and go, you need to be paying this back. I don't think it necessarily affected the Premiership that much as it possibly did the lower end clubs. Because I think they've still got the brand around the bigger clubs, but especially the likes of Millwall and stuff like that. I think that would have been a proper pinch.
Oh, it would have been a nightmare if there'd been no football last year. First of all, what we'd have done. Yeah, let's face it, we were all going stir crazy inside. You know, complying with lockdown. Having football on every day, if you did have Sky, and appreciate not everybody can afford it, it gave me an escape route because I was doing the nut. You know, all of the neighbours from my estate, they were coming around and borrowing the dog because that was one of the reasons you could go out of the house. When you think about when the first lockdown, we were not allowed out of the house unless you're going to get your groceries, so, or walking the dog. So yeah, it football certainly helped during that period.
Maybe a question we'll come on to a bit later with the FFP, because I want to know how that affects, but that's probably something for later on. I mean, we've obviously done the income, and possibly look at expenditure. That's the form we're going in.
I was just going to ask on the income. Is there much income from players sold? Have we benefited much?
No. Player sales were pretty modest, and I think this has been a feature of Millwall for quite some time. It's around about 300,000 or 400,000. Last season, it was 80,000 quid in 2020. The only year when Millwall have actually had significant player sales was 2018-19, when you sold players for around about 5.5 million. So I think this is an area that Millwall are probably looking to address because, you know, decent catchment area, you know, in that part of southeast London, you want to be picking up some talented players and you know, trying to adopt a player trading model. You know, you've seen Brentford end up in the Premier League, and the reason why they've done that is that they've spotted players, developed them, sold them on a profit, and that allowed them to plough that money back into the wage bill, and they ended up in the Premier League as a result. Millwall sales are not bad, but it's certainly an area for potential growth. But in order to have that, you need an academy, you need facilities, and so on.
I suppose, really, as well, that falls into the brand Millwall, or the perceived brand of Millwall. Also, the fact that our training ground looks like a prefab from the 1970s, 1980s, hence why they're looking to move. They're looking to set up, and I'm hearing that I thought the training ground was going to be 5 to 10 years, but people in the area I've spoken to, they're saying that Millwall's promising that it should be all up and ready within 2 to 3 years, and they're sweetening the deal a lot because they're resurfacing local football pitches, sorting out the local grassroots stuff and everything else. So I mean, it sounds as if that move would be great for Millwall, but it also sounds as if it would be great for the grassroots clubs and stuff around where they're buying their ground, where they brought their ground. So, you know, it's a win-win for everyone. And obviously, if we can get one of the best training facilities in the country, we're then likely to attract the talent who wants to develop, rather than saying, here's our training ground, and someone looks around and says, but it's a prefab building.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Good. Yep. And if you look at the amount of money that clubs are putting into this, you know, Leicester, I think they're spending about 80 or 90 million pounds on new training facilities. Spurs stuff is out of the world. And if you're the parent, and also if you're a kid, you know, you look around and you do get a little bit starry eyed at some of the stuff which is on offer. Another one of the downsides of EPPP is that it used to be that you had to live within an hour's journey of the club before you were allowed to be a youth player. That rule was scrapped. You've got clubs such as Manchester City who are putting their kids through a private school where the fees are £18,000 a year. And they could be nicking your players at the age of 10, 11, 12. But if you've got something which you can offer, and as you were saying, Mickey, you know, it's also being seen as a community-based club which is loyal to its roots, that will come back as a positive. So I think the clubs, again, got to be applauded for that.
Yeah, it's quite hard work because teams like Man City have got an under-5 elite squad, what they pick for. I mean, there's a great documentary and a great book, what Michael Calvin's done, talking about, you know, the dark world of agents and kids and everything else in football. Because you could be picked up at 3-4 years old by Man City, be in their academy till 12, 13, 14, all of a sudden your growth spout goes the wrong way, and all of a sudden you're no real benefit to them, and they just go, thank you very much, no more, and you're suddenly out in the wilderness looking for another club. Potentially you get, we've had it where, who was it, with Eze, who, you know, was dropped by us.
Eberici Eze, yeah.
Yeah, he was dropped by us, and then obviously he went on. Lots of our fans say, you know, he's pure class, why did we drop him? But again, you're not in that environment. You don't know whether or not his attitude, whether or not it's the way he was, and all of a sudden he needed a bit to grow up and have another chance and go. Because if you read about Sterling when he was younger, Sterling was an absolute nightmare. No one wanted to take a chance on him. So, yeah, we'll see. Go on, Phil, next question.
I was just going to ask Kieran, is there a direct link with clubs that you review between their income for player sales and their expenditure on players? Because, I mean, we don't spend a lot on players either, do we? So, you know, you've got to speculate to accumulate to a degree, even if you're growing your own talent.
Yeah, I think if you are growing your own talent, then it's down to having a good scouting network and also having a development. What we are seeing in the Championship is it's very much a case of sell to buy. And if we take a look at Millwall last season, they spent just under £1.5 million on players, which is actually, you know, quite significant by Championship standards, because the vast majority of clubs are either looking to get Bosmans, or they're doing loan deals, or they're bringing players through. So anybody that's spending money, it is the exception rather than the norm over the course of the last two seasons. Even the clubs that are coming down from the Premier League, they're selling first because they're trying to shift, you know, high wage earners off the wage bill, and then they're investing a proportion of that back into player recruitment.
Their recruitment. I get we ought to pick up the pace. I'm conscious everybody's time. In terms of, I guess, probably moving on to the more broader questions now, Kieran, what do you see the long-term impact now for the club in terms of FFP with these losses stacking up? Is there an implication? Are there EFL rule changes during this period? How do you see that being for us?
Well, I think the good news for Millwall is that they are pretty safe under the FFP position. You're allowed to make an FFP loss of £39 million over 3 years. There's some technical adjustments to that, but Millwall are well within the limits. So I don't perceive that as being a problem. I get the impression that John Berylson wants a broadly sustainable club, to be a club that will be able to stand on its own two feet. And when I say broadly sustainable, it means that if you take a look at Preston, their owner was putting in £7-8 million a year. If you look at Ipswich, their owner Marcus Evans around about the same. I think Millwall, you know, under John, he's putting in, you know, the best part of, you know, £8-9 million a year, and that keeps the club within its limits, and effectively that operates as your budget. You know, would the club like to be breaking even every year? Of course they would, but at the same time they want to be, you know, as competitive as you can realistically be in the Championship, and also you want to stay in the Championship, because if you drop out, your TV money goes down from £7.5 million a year to £1.5 million.
I mean, one question I've got with, obviously, with expenditure is how much has the COVID procedures and everything else impacted clubs? You know, like, obviously, they've had to buy new gateways, new turnstile bits for it, and sanitising and stickers and everything else. I mean, surely that must have all had an impact on clubs as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, all of your COVID expenditure is exempt from FFP. So both the Premier League and the EFL have said that. The costs are, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, it could be over £1 million for some clubs, because it's even some of the simple things that, you know, whereas at the start of COVID, or pre-COVID, you'd have the whole squad going to matches away from home on a single coach. Well, under social distancing, you're not allowed to that. So you might have two or three coaches. Some of the clubs were actually hiring people carriers, and no more than two players are, you know, are traveling in the people carrier together. If you're staying overnight, if you're going up to the likes of Middlesbrough, you're going up the previous night. Well, all of a sudden, it's more difficult to get hotels. You might need to go and book more rooms because you don't want players sharing a room. And all of this adds up to the costs. And they did actually become pretty significant for quite a few clubs.
Are you able to kind of almost put a rough valuation on what you think COVID over the past two sets of accounts has cost Millwall? Is there a simple sort of rule of thumb that you're looking to apply?
I wouldn't say there's a simple one, but I think you can say that you've lost a full year's worth of match day income, at least over that period. You've probably lost, you know, another 20% of your income from ancillary bits and pieces, and your cost base has gone up. So, you know, putting that together, from Millwall's point of view, I think we're probably talking somewhere in the region of, you know, 12 to 15 million pounds, which has come partly that's been funded by the owner, and also the utilisation of the furlough scheme and the EFL loan.
That's pretty scary, isn't it? Do you see an implication over the next year or two with the parachute payments in the Premiership and an even bigger divide growing between those coming down with that money and all these clubs in the Championship really struggling with their income?
Yes. I think the parachute payments do not help situations. But they're not designed to help clubs in the Championship. They're designed to prevent those clubs that are getting relegated from going bust. When you are competing, you know, the clubs, and the thing about the parachutes is that they are guaranteed payments. So they've not gone down significantly as a result of COVID, although the Premier League itself has been hit by a reduction in its TV money, and the parachutes are linked to that indirectly. I think it amplifies the gap between the clubs that which have been relegated and the clubs which were existing in the Championship, which is frustrating. Although there's exactly the same in the Premier League itself. Those clubs which are qualifying for the Champions League each season, you know, they are effective parachutes because that's money which the other 14 clubs don't have. So there's big issues in terms of the lack of fairness when it comes to distribution. And of course, everybody, if you talk to chief executives of clubs in the Premier League, they say, yeah, we want fair distribution, provided it, you know, it's the same as we're all hypocrites to a certain hit. We all want more money for our club.
Do you think it's too blunt an instrument, though, Kieran?
I think they're too high, and I think my approach is I think they're a bit too high, and I think they go on for too long. So I'd certainly restrict them to 2 years.
If a club comes down and reduces all of their wage bill massively and sells their star player for 40 million quid, but then they still benefit from the parachute payments, which in theory they might not actually need, sustainable. Yeah.
If they sell that player for 40 million quid, I'm with you. So, I mean, some of them, if you look at Sunderland, when they came down, they came down with a bunch of turkeys. And Sunderland had 2 years' worth of Premier League parachute payments in League One and failed to get up. Yeah, you've got to question the people in charge of that club as to their inability to run it on a professional basis. So, I think they're too high. I think they go on for too long. I've read the Tracy Crouch report. I've read all 162 pages twice, and it doesn't say scrap them. It says you need to get your heads, you know, the EFL and the Premier League need to come to some form of agreement, and that's the problem with having a breakaway league like the Premier League, because it's not acting in the interests of all the clubs in the country.
Is that what you were touching on in terms of the redistribution needing to sort of match the regulation so that it all comes together in a joined up way?
Yes. Yeah, because if you if you just scrap parachute payments, there's a genuine danger of clubs going bust when they're relegated. If you take a look at the wage bills of those clubs that do come down, they're coming down on average by 40% in the first season. And that's with parachute payments. So it probably does give them an advantage. So I'd certainly think that they're too high. What's going to happen with that? But if you then say, well, we've now got an extra, you know, 50 million, 100 million pounds a year from parachute payments to be spread in the EFL, well, 100 million quid spread between 72 clubs isn't a huge amount of money.
No,
definitely. Because it is quite you know, heavy towards the team what comes down, which means that they're on an unfair advantage to potentially go straight back up anyway, aren't they? So, yeah.
Is there anything looking forward, sort of coming to the close from my point of view, is there anything in the Crouch review that you think Millwall as a club and as fans we should look forward to in terms of the implementation? What changes do you think we can see at our level?
I think you're clearly closer to the club than I am in terms of, you know, you're supporting the club 365 days a year. I quite like the idea of the golden share, which would, and yeah, there's no indication under the present ownership that this would be an issue, but sort of preserving those things which you hold dear as Millwall fans. So, you know, the crest, the colour of the shirt, where you play at present, you know, to have a veto over those decisions if somebody proposes a move. You know, the last thing you want is, you know, somebody to come along and try to do an MK Dons on Millwall. So I think that would be really positive. I quite like the idea of the licensing of clubs, that it's to stop the likes of Mel Morris at Derby County from using creative ways to try to get an advantage over other clubs in the division, and the regulator would just say, well, you know, we're not going to, you know, we make the rules, we are going to take away your license to own this club if you carry on behaving in the ways you do. So it's, I think that would be quite a useful stick. How easy that will be to get through, because we've already seen some pretty snarky remarks from Karen Brady, Angus Kinnear at Leeds, Christian Purslow, the private equity fund manager at Aston Villa, Steve Parrish. You know, all of these sort of somewhat sniffy comments. A lot of work's gone into that. I think the report is fair. It's not that radical. It's not North Korea as is being claimed.
No, but the trouble is that these are all private businesses as such, aren't they? And it's sort of like what people are sitting there saying, well, you know, they don't want to invest that money in and then suddenly be told, actually, you're not in charge, you know, you don't have a license to operate no more. I think that's where people are a bit, and it'll be interesting to see how they change the rules to facilitate that. I agree with you. I think it should come in. But it's, again, it's watching. We're lucky where we are. We're lucky. We've got a great chairman,
yep,
who, you know, is behind the club, invests and everything else, that he's great at what he does. But I wouldn't want to have the Derby guy and be along those lines, because it would just be absolute, you know, it'd be absolute turmoil. And I think that we'd be in such a bad position over the last so many years if we had someone like that. But
I agree. I mean, there was a documentary done by Al Jazeera called The Men Who Sell Football Clubs. It wasn't mainly about Derby, but Derby's owner did appear on it. I can't say too much apart from the fact that I was on that show as well, and I've seen all the footage which didn't get through the lawyers. So, and I think if people did see some of that, they might be slightly disappointed in the way that some people connected to the football industry hold the game and hold the fans in such contempt.
It's a money-making machine. And the trouble is that when you have a successful machine, what makes money what it does, unfortunately, you're going to have a few unsavoury people involved in it, who are all they're interested in is taking a pay packet, whichever way they can. We've seen it over the years with, you know, managers and other bits and pieces taking backhanders, this, that, and the other. And unfortunately, at the moment, there is no way of being able to stop that. We know that allegedly the Premiership and all that, when they want a player, go buy the parents a house or buy the parents a new car and et cetera, like that to get in. It's supposed to be frowned upon and it's not supposed to happen. But, you know, there's ways around it where there aren't, you know, twice removed and further along the line get something and it's all paid back. So there's ways around it. But, yeah, I mean, look, coming on, we've been in it thingy. I mean, what are your standouts on the accounts for you?
The club's got a generous owner. If you take a look at the total losses, you know, running Millwall Football Club is not going to make you rich. Over the years, the club's lost £114 million. And, you know, John Berylson has said every year, here's a cheque. I'm enjoying the experience. And he's been there for at least a decade. Is that right?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I think 10 or 12 years now, isn't it?
Yep. So I think that continued support at is what a, you know, is a huge sum of money. And there are lots of good guys in football. Steve Gibson does the same at Borough, Marcus Evans, Trevor Hemmings at Preston, you know, and they're not getting any glory out of it. Apart from the fact it's a team where, you know, they've got an emotional link in the same way that we do with our clubs, except they also happen to be successful in other aspects of their life and they've decided to invest it in football. But it's the vast majority of football clubs is a license to lose money.
In terms of the difference between, to kind of reassure fans a little bit with what happened with Derby, you know, accrued huge debts, which has been seems to have been their biggest problem, is just the variety and the volume of debts that they've got. Where do you see Mill's debt position at the moment? I mean, we've obviously got an outstanding EFL loan, but, you know, are you familiar with kind of what loan to equity conversion's been with the chairman and the board?
Yeah, what the club is doing is that the owner's putting in money in the form of loans, and then those loans get converted into shares, or he's putting it in these days in what's referred to as B shares. That's a lot more secure because, yeah, worst case scenario, and there is no evidence that this will happen, if Millwall went bust, what you have to do is you have to pay off all of your football creditors, and there's not significant football creditors. All of your HMRC has to be paid 100%. Millwall are up to date with a HMRC, and then you've got to go and pay a quarter of all your other liabilities, but all your other debts. Well, because Millwall are being funded through shares, you don't have to go and pay a quarter of the value of the shares back. So that they will always be a more attractive proposition to a potential new owner on the back of that. What happened at Derby County was horrendous. You know, people have already lost their jobs. I used to work in the insolvency industry. I put my hand up here. So I've had Derby County employees phoning up me asking where do they stand from a legal point of view, you know, because they've been doing X, Y, and Z. And then all the stories start to come out about how the club has been run, and this isn't the right place to talk about them. You know, I don't think I should be telling tales out of school. And it was really depressing and really shocking that it's local people working for the club that they love. They're making sacrifices. It's, you know, it's if there's no bibs for some of the youth teams, well, you know, the coaches will go and find the money for the bibs themselves and things like that. And it's not, I'm not saying that happened at Derby. I'm not saying it didn't happen at Derby. But, you know, these are the type of horror stories that you hear. And then the owner decides he gets bored and just walks away, having sold the ground to himself. So the administrators have got – the administrators, what are they selling? They're selling the name of Derby County for a club which is realistically going to be in League One, and they've got to find at least £60 million to pay off the football creditors, HMRC, and some outstanding loans.
I was just going to say, so the sort of takeaways from this really from you are, we're a well-run club, we're not laden with debt, with the new training facility upcoming, you know, the next 3 to 5 to 10 years looks super bright from that point of view. And it's a well-managed, well-funded, well-supported club by the, and to be fair to John Berylson, there is a board of directors that invest as well. There are other smaller investing directors, but we have to give them credit too, because it's all comparative to your net worth, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Millwall are a solid run club. And the frightening thing is, as a well-run club, you're still losing millions of pounds a year. And that's, that shows us that there's something fundamentally challenging in the world of football. And, you know, the wage bill was £9 million in 2016-17, when I think you were still in League One, and it's now best part of £21 million. Yeah, to compete in the Championship is an expensive business, and how we get wage control into football is a problem, because you've got some clubs in your division, such as Stoke City, who say, well, we don't care what we pay in wages. Yeah, we're being bankrolled by the gambling industry, and that makes a fortune out of football. So, you know, how do we have a sensible series of checks and balances is difficult. And, you know, Mickey said, you know, they are private businesses, but if I'm running a pub, I need a license. If I'm running a casino, I need a license. Yep. No, if I'm running a lap dancing bar.
Yep.
Who's done that?
I have done that. Yeah.
There's a whole the lap dancing there. Or running
there's,
it.
There's a whole new show there. Do you know what I mean? But I mean, what? Just a quick one before we do finish up. I mean, people have got to take in an understanding of what John Berylson does, because John Berylson doesn't own the ground. He doesn't own the stadium. He doesn't own the training ground currently, and pretty much the only tangible assets he has are the players and the youth players coming up. As a whole, there isn't, you know, the redevelopment isn't there yet. Again, that will be a benefit if and when that goes. Probably not within my lifetime, if I'm honest. I'll be surprised if it does. But once that kicks off and the new training facility, then they'll actually have something that they own. But right now, they don't actually own the stadium or the training ground. So the money he's putting in is pretty much a high risk for him, because there isn't any way for him to get that back at the minute.
Yeah, he's the equivalent of the bank of mum and dad.
Yeah, pretty much.
In the sense that, yeah, okay, he's putting the money in, and he's betting shares, and he's put some in. Yeah, there is some outstanding in loans, but that'll be the interest on those loans gets written off. Yeah, it's a bit like if I, you know, like he's saying, I want to buy my first car, Dad. Will you help me? Will you lend me some money? And you go, yeah, okay. And you know you're never going to see it. You just have to go and say, you know, but if it's something that you love, then. Yeah. It's a different environment.
And I think he has fallen in love with Millwall. You know, I think at the beginning, he probably didn't realise what he was getting getting involved in. But I think over the years, it's got hold of him, and he knows what we are. I think morally, we're very similar in our morals, as in the club morals and the chairman's morals. And I think that he'll always defend us to the hilt. And he doesn't have any problem putting his hand in his pocket. And hopefully over the next so many years with the training ground and other stuff being planned, that hopefully we can have some way of giving him not so much expenditure each year. I mean, bringing this show to a close, we go to you first, Phil. I mean, is there any points that you just want to raise from this? Any snippets that you've taken on and went, oh, I didn't know that, or...
There's some really good stuff in there from Kieran. It's really helpful to understand a little bit more about the FFP, you know, the loan situation with the Football League. So thank you for that. Really grateful for your time. I'm just reassured that whilst these are huge losses, you have to put them in the context of a mad world that we're in. It's not a normal, you can't think about it in a normal way. And, you know, I don't know, if you're giving the club a score out of 10 for its management through a very, very difficult crisis, you know, you're probably looking at maybe a 7 or an 8 out of 10, I guess.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I don't see what else they could have done.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. And also, Millwall never get a mention on the Price of Football podcast. And that's good.
Yes, very true.
You talk to Derby fans; they are sick and tired of.
Unless it's the uncle.
Yeah. I mean, Kieran, you got any final words you want to say? Any snippets what you know you want people to know or just take on before we close up?
I think Millwall fans should be first of all reassured, and secondly, they should be proud of the way that their club is being managed.
I totally agree. And look, we're bringing this to an end, but I think over the last 2 years, the way Millwall fans, those that can afford it, have got involved, those who carried over their season tickets, those who've made donations, those who've brought crowdies, those who've supported the club by buying shirts, tops, training facility, you know, training tops, using different parts of the facilities, the trust, et cetera, all the way down to giving stuff to the food bank, supporting charities. You know, you don't stop to amaze me. From the Poppy Day a couple of weeks ago, where we raised best part of over 27 grand in a day for the British Legion, was unbelievable. Considering what we're going through, we still do. But unfortunately, we never get the media, we never get the publicity for it. And if I'm honest, I don't ever want to start getting the publicity for it, because we are what we are, and people within and people who are close to the fan base in the Millwall setup, we know what we do, and we don't need to scream and shout about it. We don't need it to be covered by national newspapers. We know what we do. We're proud of our club. We're proud of our fan base. So, look, thanks very much for listening. Hopefully, it's given you a snippet into the accounts from Millwall. Obviously, if you've got any questions, I'm sure Kieran will take them. Just get in touch with him on Twitter. There we go. Job done. If you like the shows, we are across YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. All you need to do is just type in That Millwall Pod. Find us. We are available on all good podcasts, Apple, Amazon, etc. Again, That Millwall Podcast. Thanks very much for listening. We will be back later this week with another show. And for now, that's it from me. Thanks, Kieran, for joining. And thanks, Phil, for giving up your time this morning. So, have a good day, chaps.
Cheers, guys.